Okay, let's get talking. Now, I've asked you if you mind about me recording. I think what we've just done here is actually, from our various perspectives, generated some really valuable data. This thing is going to be tricky. If infrastructure is something we really need to hit on the head, it's going to be really tricky to communicate it. So before we go any further, can we just give an indication of the roles that we have in our institution? In other words, we have these perceptions. Where are we standing? So can I ask you to put your hand up if you would regard yourself as a teacher in any way, an academic? So we have... And you can might put your hands up several times. So we've got a few academics here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So out of the 22 people, 8 at least put their hands up there. So what else what might we have? Learning technologists, the people who work really on behalf of academics to interpret ideas with technology. So quite a few ideas, people there. In fact, as many. Just hold your hands up while I count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So yeah, that was good. Now, a bit of crossover here of those two things, educational developers. So you might have a role around staff development. You might, yeah, so we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay, and what else might we have? Administrators, managers. Jethro, you're on your own. No, we've got 1, 2, 3. Okay, so you would be informing strategy and policy and managing people. What other sort of roles might I have asked for that I've just totally forgotten about that might be relevant to this conversation?
Researchers.
Researchers.
Yeah, we no teaching, no direct, it's just research.
Okay.
To practice.
Okay, so would you regard yourself as a researcher?
That is what I do.
Okay, so that's firmly your position. Anyone else here doing that sort of work?
No, I'm a student as well.
Okay. Okay, let's go for the researchers. Show of hands. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, and yeah, students. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You've just stopped. You can be a student.
Can I be a student? Or
7. Okay, so 6, let's say.
People who play a role within their department or faculty with respect to learning enhancement in addition to their academic
development.
Yeah, did you put your hand up for educational development? Okay, we'll add one to educational development. I'm just making notes here. Okay.
No, I can think of about 150 people at the University of Sheffield who just think they've not been accounted for yet.
Okay, any big one?
They'd be people who like those yellow wiring pictures.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, who's here today? I think we know who's here today. So who's informing this discussion? Right, what I need to do, and I can't because I'm standing right here, is get a sense of where the clusters are. Let's start with the clusters. So can someone sort of tell me where the clusters are?
It's in the centre.
We've got academic support, access to kit. This one, coordination, institutional drivers. Okay, pick one to start. Anyone?
Coordination.
Coordination, what's that mean? Shall I read through some of the things that are up here?
Yeah.
Okay, so our infrastructure is weak because of poor management.
You're up.
Teaching and learning priorities aren't IT and T's priorities. Okay, so there's a mismatch within the supporting departments. We lose content because we don't know about events until after the fact. Coordination and collaboration are always successful. Does that say? University Sunderland. I'm going there. Okay.
Not always.
Crucial word. I tend to miss that word out when I'm writing, which becomes a real problem. Okay. Okay, we've got a flavour now. I can't read all the handwriting, it has to be said. But I will do afterwards and I'll transcribe all these things. Coordination then. Let's just have a bit of a discussion about what that means in terms of infrastructure and weakness.
Is that next to institutional drivers deliberately? Because I wonder if we looked at the two side by side, we might start finding a little
bit.
I did do a bit of that, but I realised it would be wrong to try and do too much of it. So we've got the wiry stuff at that end and we've got the people-y stuff at this end. Coordination then. Any thoughts that we'd like to develop? Any notes that I haven't read out there? Yeah.
I think that as an academic, it's sometimes hard to know who to ask, because you might have people in a learning development services that can help you with one thing, but then you want to do web two, and then you have to ask somebody else, and then you have to think who's their boss, and then ask for their time. And it's people are dotted all over the place, and it's very, very difficult to access the help that you might want. In some regards.
Okay.
Because if you ask, where are they?
So we can see this very broad picture, and you as the end user has got to be able to access this service. Yeah, exactly. And you've got to know how the service works.
Yeah. Is that because the institution is designed for a different era? And maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago that model was okay, but now the present model requires you to contact a whole range of people, whereas before you probably didn't need to contact so many people, because you didn't have so many bright ideas or whatever, you know, you didn't have so many needs to, the learning needs yourself. Maybe the structure of the university hasn't changed.
No, you're right.
Pace with what your requirements as an academic
is. I think you're right. So we've got an academic development unit, but I might need to contact people in IT who are in student services.
Yeah.
But they're not designed to help staff. So when you try to get staff who want the help from people to do more techie things on computers.
I think that one of the issues here is that if you look across a sector at different institutions, you will find the same people located in so many different places within an institution, whether it's a learning technologist, whether it's an education developer, it will vary from institution to institution. Mm. And that, I think, is part of the difficulty that people face in terms of trying to understand and make sense of organisations and things, because sometimes there's not an obvious rationale behind some of these.
I think what you get as well from having worked in, went to my university and worked in it since 92, is that you get this sort of centralisation, decentralisation wave going on. You get it in government as well, and everybody gets pissed off with the centralised thing because it doesn't quite fit your needs. So everything starts moving out and everybody's happy. Well, no, nobody's ever happy for any amount of time. And then everybody realises that it's not coordinated, and you've got people buying this software there and that software and their hardware, and then, oh, we've got to get it centralised. And I think it keeps new VCs in jobs because they just do the opposite of what's been going on.
And in some places, that wiry technical bandwidth, technical end is more likely to be dealt with and managed across the university, whereas at this end we're seeing e-learning advisors in subject groups in some cases, or if not e-learning advisors, just academics that are into it. And being into podcasting at this stage of the development of educational podcasting is quite a big factor as well. I'd suggest that there are some people that just had to find out, like me, because it seemed to fit with where my head was at. So you get some people, And it's hard to manage, and but it's not an even pattern. So okay, let's keep going. Let's move on to another cluster for the moment, unless anyone wants to make another contribution. Yeah.
I think for me the two at the centre are the kind of key things. Mm. I think some of the solutions that are practical to help academics need some back end strategy, processes, management being put in place before you can offer the solutions. So for instance, in our place we have a single email that you would know about to go to help in this area. Now of course you need a huge kind of pyramid of support that supports that single email, because this is one of these rare things that go across lots of different silos of activity with lots of different skills base, lots of different aspects.
Okay, so that sounds like a bit of a solution, that single point of access for support.
But you need to have a pyramid behind it. You don't want to have one man and a dog who goes on holiday for 4 weeks.
Okay.
And then you need consistency as well, because you might ask somebody over here who will say, oh, brilliant, do this, have a workshop on that, and then you come back to your department and there's two IT guys that you want to do that for. Oh, no, sorry, we don't have sound consistency. Sorry.
My first question, and I've raised it already, was about how much of this stuff can any one person know. Is there anyone in this room who would say that they are confident that they know about all of this area? Yeah, great.
But because it's me, I'm putting that, I do all of that. I run the repository, I'm sick of different IT services and I look after the network. I don't go to anyone else because I do it all, but the university's not willing to put the resources in to expand in that. So.
What size institution are you?
We're fairly big, we're the 8th biggest in Scotland, so 20,000 students.
Okay.
But that goes back to my point.
So everyone can come to you.
That's a bad situation. It's lacking in institutional support. It's lacking in this general skill set and staff development, lots of things. So this person should feel that they have at least a triangle of support around them. Otherwise, you've got a classic weak point in the system.
I think one of the difficulties is that senior managers know absolutely nothing about to generalise most about technology enhanced learning. Most of them, I'm a dean, obviously, but I mean, I would say that if you look back over the past 5 years or so, Pro Vice Chancellors, for example. Deans of Learning Teaching would probably have thought, e-learning, we've got a VLE, we've done that. And you've got that kind of syndrome. And so unless you have that, and those two things in the middle there, institutional drives of coordination, what that tells me is that what we have here is some sort of primary, as it were, causal or underpinning factors, and then we have sort of symptomatic things that flow from it sort of thing. And unless there's a clear understanding there, with strategy, most institutions do not know what they want to try to do with e-learning or technology. They simply don't know. And I think that's part of the kind of messiness that we're at in terms of stage of development and so on. And why we have single individuals, we got one in our place, the one man and the dog goes on holiday for 3 weeks and nothing gets done, That's how it is, that's how senior managers often see things. They empower somebody, that's sorted out because he's kind of doing that. None of this, of course, has anything to do with e-learning. It's just they kind of see technology sort of thing.
Can I ask you a question? How do people convince people like you? Julie referred to evidence this morning. What does evidence look like when it hits the desk, your desk, and that colleagues?
I mean, in a sense, you don't have to kind of convince me with evidence, because I mean, I see, through the sort of things that I observe at these gatherings, plus guys in my own institution who are sort of doing good stuff, who I try to support and encourage and so on and so forth. But one of the difficulties that I face as one of a number of senior managers is that, as I said earlier on, I'm presenting my business plan to the other members of the senior management team in 2 weeks' time, And of course, we'd all be wheeled in, But there'll be kind of Mr. or Miss Whiting participation, there'll be Mr. or Miss Learning Resources, there'll be... You can imagine that there are competing voices here, And so that whole kind of, it's policy overload, isn't it? And trying to make sense of all of that at the top of an institution, which is where a vice-chancellor is, it's all kind of noise, isn't it? So it's interesting stuff, but there are lots of conflicts and about budgets and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I actually thought of taking in Andrew's little sheet earlier on with the Likert scales to this SMT presentation in 2 weeks' time. And say, well, look, sit and just leave that there as I'm leaving and say, look, what's your answers to these questions? You just asked me what my picture is of in 5 years' time, That's it kind of thing, But I mean, what does it mean in terms of actually altering the sort of strategy of the university? So that's the difficulty there, really, is that all of this stuff gets caught up in all that sort of,
Right, a lot of competing voices. Let's go for the research angle.
Well, I think maybe the question you asked has to do with evidence and what would convince. I think Gilly used the example of John Fothergill's failure was the evidence that there was less research. And assuming there were 100 people who were continuing to fail, and therefore, in terms of student assessment or some way of grading the university, that will have an impact, then, let's go for it. So sometimes you think maybe it's a negative consequence of what is not happening, which convinces them. And if that is the case, maybe throw more of that in. I don't know.
Just hold on, Peter. Let's just take a breather for a second and just have another look at the wall, because I want you to decide where else to go now with this conversation. Okay, let's shift the direction. Where should we go next? What needs to be talked about here?
But it's interesting that people seem to think that help and student support are not big problems.
Okay, should we just test that? Are help and student support big problems or not?
I think they're lower down the scale, and that we focused on these bigger obstacles. That's how I immediately started thinking. I kind of went to the top and left my things by institutional drivers. So it's not that those things aren't problems, but those things have to be solved first, which someone mentioned earlier. For me,
I think often the driver for producing e-learning actually comes from students. I think sometimes it can be actually the other way around, which is what I was going to say about the institutional drivers. I think one thing that I think is noticeably absent from the National Student Survey is anything at all about how the e-learning or how computers are used to enhance learning in, you know, it's just completely absent from the student survey. And I've worked at a couple of institutions in the past year, and they both take such, you know, they take such emphasis from this survey. I think if it included a section on, because it would impact the student service, the student experience so much. If you went to a university that completely didn't have a VLE, didn't post notes up there, didn't use podcasts, and you went to one that was completely the other extreme, I think you'd have such a difference of experience, and yet that's not reflected.
Okay, let's just see what others think about the point you've made. We're talking really about what drives the drivers, and the National Student Survey is a classic one, isn't it? It's a convenient, well-packaged little instrument, but I think many people would agree that it doesn't necessarily reflect where we're at now, as you're saying, and possibly where we need to be in 5 years' time. What other?
I think what drives drivers is an excellent question. Actually, it feeds into the question, you know, what would drive? Okay, we know Jethro is a very sympathetic, is pro e-learning, lots of areas. But there's lots of people like Jethro who aren't. And one of the things we hear anecdotally, sort of the University of Sheffield, from admissions tutors, is the most commonly asked question at any open day now. Of course, little Johnny's notes will all be on the campus VLE, won't they, like they are at the school that he goes to, or the FE college that he goes to, whatever. And that is something, I don't know whether that's being fed, I don't know how widely that gets fed back up the system, but, you know, there is a big driver, because, you know, why do we care so much about NSS? Well, because we're worried about revenue income, we're worried about revenue streams, we're worried about an uncertain future, we're worried about...
It's a business model, exactly,
so, you know, yeah.
Okay, are there any other tech... Sorry, yeah, let's have you...
Sorry, I didn't put any notes up on there.
That's terrible.
As a student at the OU, I didn't feel qualified enough to say, you know, where I thought the holes were. But what I would say is, obviously, the students, if I can borrow market terminology, are the customers or, you know, the clients of the universities. And so, really, you know, when you're thinking of drivers... At the end of the day, there must be something in there about what are the needs of the students. So rather than just thinking, well, here's something we think might be useful, let's give it to them. You know, at some stage, there has to be an input, because obviously they are important stakeholders.
And I think most people, I guess, would be there. But the question remains, what other instruments, apart from the inadequate National Student Survey, could we be using perhaps to... we're talking generally now about any institutional drivers and the way we inform them, but let's try and focus it back on podcasting or educational media.
The student feedback certainly drove the more and more colleagues to use the VLE, because the feedback came through the annual monitoring that those students who experienced it on one module were complaining and giving negative feedback to the other modules, saying, well, how can we get this fantastic stuff here, but we do geography, and there's nothing ever there.
Okay, so they were complaining. How did that complaining get communicated?
It came through the annual monitoring process, so that it got reported up through the
quality assurance.
Through the AD, really.
Yeah, that's common if you've got sort of combined honours structures.
Combined honours students were the ones that were doing it in the first
In English they do this, but in history they still make a student.
So we should be paying attention maybe a wee bit more to those combined honours.
A lot of universities put a lot of... They listen much, much more to the students than they do to the staff. Mm-hmm. For the very reasons you said, they're the customer. And, you know, many staff would get students to say something they don't know. And they actually do listen to them. So I think you can, that does drive changes, and as a result of that, you know, e-learning strategies have been implemented across the whole university, really because of the feedback that came through all the
channels. Yeah.
It was interesting what you said about the NSS survey, and this relates to the points you just made, because we designed our own survey at Reading as an alternative to the NSS, because we disliked it so much, and we had quite a detailed section on e-learning, and we are using that in our kind of strategies for changing things in the institution, and the results are being put forward in areas like the department's periodic review processes. So it really is being used as a driver for change.
Okay, so consider, you know, the validity of your instruments, basically, and redesign them if necessary.
Playing with some departments and just using the NSS as their feedback. Full stop. So just say, if you want to give feedback about this course, get online and fill in that survey. That was the...
a bit clumsy.
That was the, yeah, I mean, not all departments did that, so I'm not... Yeah. I'm not
okay, yes.
Well, one thing that I find interesting at our institute is that our strategic learning initiatives are coming more into line with the business objectives of our institution. And there's a lot of business drivers that are directly affecting what we're doing now, especially in regards to distance learning, attracting students from other countries to our institutions. And it seems to be at the right time when things such as podcasts are becoming more and more prevalent because of that mesh between the business model of our institution and what's actually going on with our academics and what to teach.
Yeah, I choose totally about podcasting. You know, it's kind of bringing together the, you know, that, you know, iTunes U. I think I've spoken with a few people about it.
Yeah,
it's kind of bringing together that element of marketing the university on one hand,
yeah,
then using rich media on the other hand, and kind of the both things are coming together. And if the university is behind it, then that's something that can kind of bring the business model with it.
There's definitely a session to be had, and you're going to be doing it, I think, at one of the next suits.
Yeah.
But you know, let's not go there now. But let's note it as an aspect of infrastructure.
I'll just chip in with something I think is overlooked a lot, and I think there's no, you know, in terms of business models and stuff like that. It's not been mentioned this morning, but it's all marketing.
Yeah.
Now, this gentleman over here, you know your position in the marketplace. You'll have meetings that's discussing where you're going, how do you get compete with, you know, institution X, how do you get student numbers up, retention down, you know, marketing, how much to spend on the budget, blah, 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 communication. It is, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a good, solid way of thinking about business model. And if you can present the vision for that area to the managers, so they don't even have to come up with a vision, they just, you just spend a small amount of money to move forward in this area of communication, marketing, presence in the market. And another trick is just to think of things like libraries. How much do you spend on books? That gives you a ballpark figure of money. Then how much do you value the asset of the academics in your institution?
Mm-hmm.
How podcasting is very, very cheap. How can you get those academics to contribute something very simply that reflects their interest, their expertise, their research? And compare that to, say, other initiatives like marketing, libraries. You've got to present the package to the managers. Don't expect them to kind of sit there on a Friday afternoon with a book.
Exactly. Yeah, Jilly said it this morning, and it's about communicating these things very clearly and touching the, you know, pressing the right buttons, isn't it?
I think
really?
Using that kind of juxtaposition between business case and pedagogic case and doing that politically in an astute and, you know, cute way, I think is really important. Because, you know, vice chancellors will listen when you start talking about student retention.
Yeah.
More than they will listen when you start talking about assessment feedback. Yeah.
I'd like to shift the focus, if that's all right. I'm just aware of the time and trying to cover a bit more of the breadth of it. I mean, obviously, what we've said is coordination and institutional drivers are really important for us to get right. We've started to explore what that might mean. One of the things that came up in this morning's session, and it always comes up, in fact, often in anything you read about educational podcasting, is, and if we're thinking about the pervasive use of digital media across the institution, you know, there are always going to be those academics who are prepared to take a few risks and come forward, and there are probably a larger proportion of our teaching staff who are more reticent and risk averse. If we believe that we should not be ignoring this, we need to know how to communicate and get those reticent people on board. We need to reduce the risk, and that's partly why we're looking at infrastructure, but we need to then be able to communicate to them why they should come on board. So let's have a look at academic support, and have we got educational development? Oh yeah, here we go. I was standing next to it. I can't read the writing. Let's talk about, sorry, but I will transcribe these and share them back. How, or can we, is anyone successfully really communicating in the mainstream with their academic in terms of CPD around technology? Anyone?
Well, we at Sunderland University recently set up a system to offer workshops to academic staff across the university and all the departments and schools. And we advertise these online. We have a portal where they are sort of advertised and people can sign up. We also offer personal support, individual lectures, and that works actually better than the workshops.
It does. And that's what they want, yes. Isn't it?
That's
and I have
want.
To come back to you then.
Yes.
That sounds very expensive.
Well,
can we go mainstream on that with that strategy?
Yes, with a bigger group of people, yes, we can. But you need the support of the institution. It's not a one-man band. I mean, you shouldn't have one person doing everything.
Okay.
You can't. If you want to achieve something good, that's valued and will bring real change, you need a team, a super team.
Yeah.
And that means money.
It does. It does. Let's face up to it.
So.
You know, money's got to be there. Carol, you...
Yeah, I'm the individual one-person, one-man band, at Chester. And the podcasting, to be perfectly honest, has been the one that's had the most... if I run a series of 5 or 6 one-hour practical sessions, I rotate them, and the podcasting was the show the most interest. And because it was only a one-hour session, we couldn't have a practical or anything, but they said...
Yeah.
Let me I need a hands-on now. So that was quite good. So I tend to run an afternoon where they can come. Those that come to the one-hour session can come to the practical session. I've just been started to be invited into departmental meetings now. What do you want? And again, podcasting it. So I'm doing another one within a department. So I'm trying to get in. There's lots of different ways I'm trying to hit it at the moment.
Lots of different ways.
And it's also important to have good links with other units in the university. I mean, for example, there's an issue, isn't there? Where's your learning technologists? Where are they? Where are they located in the organisation? Yeah? Carol is with me. She was brought out as a common as a senior lecturer because she was an academic, because she understands things like assessment, for example. Yeah? So that kind of alignment is really important.
So somehow we've got a... Mainstreaming involves getting out to the subject groups or the disciplines.
Yeah.
I mean, Robin from my place is here today. He did mention he was coming. But he's out in a faculty in health and wellbeing, and it's now his job. He's taken ownership of it. And I just sit and write the papers now. You were going to say something, I think.
Yeah. I mean, starting with coming back from feedback, we had an e-learning strategy which had to get everybody up to a certain minimum threshold. And to do that, the university put on a whole load of staff development. But the thing that really, really worked in our faculty was that we decided to have corridor conversations. So anybody who had ever had any money, I designed a template. I didn't do one myself because I didn't want to be seen as the one who was like, oh, he's keen, muffy, swatty. And so I managed to persuade about 8 of my colleagues just to do a very simple poster. We have a nice poster printer. Put them in 2 buildings, and then I put a massive big poster of just what the staff development sessions were, but it was very much the purpose of them. It wasn't.
So
it was the why.
Yeah.
It was a really simple
corridor conversations. That's quite a nice technique.
Right.
So were you there when the posters were up at all?
Well, I put the posters up.
You put the posters up, but did you stand next to it and talk to it?
Oh, no. So what happened then is I just got feedback from my colleagues because I got people from different parts. So I had somebody in the 50s who'd been using Turnitin and Grademark and was quite an unexpected enthusiast for that, people were using different things in the different aspects of the VLE, who you may or may not have thought, just from all the different disciplines. And so it was. I got lots of really interesting feedback, but the actual factual evidence is that across the departments, if you were to look at the numbers of staff that went on the training courses, 20, 20, 20, 100.
Yeah, that's
so, you know, 90%.
Right, so knowing
90%,
what?
And so the difference between the other departments was, you know, everybody would say, no, you know, the university, why, you know, it's always us and them, isn't it? And they were saying, what are they doing about it? Why aren't they supporting us? Well, the truth was, they were. There was all these roadshows and workshops, but it was just kind of getting them, and just a very simple poster in the foyer. So,
some of the simpler techniques. Also, I think the personality thing is, you know, the central local tension is often, I can't approach that person that...
The coffee room conversations and the people chatting in the...
Some of these things only need 5 minutes.
But it took no time at all to make the posters. And
so,
I'm happy to give anybody,
you know, we often think of 1 hour workshops or sessions like this or days like this, but actually to break through some of the communication and open up, in my experience, I've been sort of in this for getting on for 20 years now, it's the little impromptu things. I think everyone actually would say the things that really work when you have like gem of a conversation in a corridor over a cup of coffee. It wasn't planned, it wasn't in Outlook, blah blah blah. Okay, Graham, were you going to say something?
Just, I mean, just really it's reiterating something that's emerging, and it's something that Julie said this morning. We do seem to be on the crest of some sort of a wave here, because like Andrew, I've been an e-learning advisor at the University of Sheffield for 17 years now, and I've been trying to engage academics in all sorts of workshops, introduction to e-learning, introduction to multimedia authoring using Toolbot, introduction to Dreamweaver, 20, 25, podcasting, secretary's on the phone, Graham, forgot to move the lecture to a room that will hold 200 people. And that was last November, and it just went whatong like that. Backed up by, I do 20 a day, 2 half-day sessions on hands-on podcasts. Okay, it's a bit of a workload, but 200 academics through the door in 3 months. And people are just doing it. Now, the question that I had, one of the struggles with, it was me that wrote the Completely Unintelligible Education Development Note, by the way.
And what does it say?
It says our staff need developing... Question mark. I guess what I actually mean is, I want to go one stage further than that. That you can get them through the door and get them to do the stuff, but what I'm less sure about now is how you get them to actually do this to implement later.
I ran a pilot with hundreds of people signed up, and at the end of it, 25, which was great, took part.
Yeah.
I think on that topic, what we've found at Bradford is that we've sort of moved away from workshops because we were getting the same 20 or 25
minute
workshops.
What
we realised is we were raising awareness, but we weren't getting action.
Implementation.
So now we've gone from a model where we're targeting individuals and course teams, and that's been much more effective. Things are changing on the ground now, whereas before we were raising awareness but no action.
Mm.
Now we're targeting individuals and course teams, and we're getting action. We're seeing changes occurring in the curriculum.
Okay, maybe we'll pick up on this in a sec, but maybe going viral with that as well. So you've got to say
We're still kind of the sessions that we give tended to be on, say, the ones on e-assessment. We give e-assessment using question mark perception, and the sessions tended to be the kind of hands-on, the sort of thing that had really put a technophobe off. And what we're moving to now is where we're tapping into the kind of teaching development department of the university and creating a series of workshops called things like The Problem with Assessment. They run workshops on like voice modulation, and so we're going to try in the learning technology group try and sort of come in through the back door and kind of just have a few little devices at the back, so the prompt a discussion about what kind of problems do you have with assessment, for example, and then we kind of listen to those problems and present them with solutions. And so it's actually you're not kind of saying this is a great new tool we've got to grabbing people like a magnet onto this new tool. You kind of say, what problem do you have? And then this is how we might be able to solve it using podcasting, using question mark perception, or using...
Okay, so that comes down to encouraging people to articulate, going
to
back
talk
to what
about
I...
the pedagogical problems rather than technological.
But to
solutions.
Articulate, go through the process of stating a problem. It then stands to be solved. One thing that I would offer to this is the thing that has been the most successful thing I've ever been involved in by a million miles, and it's a real gem. It's audio feedback.
Mm.
You know, whatever you think of the National Student Survey, you know, that is the big message. Feedback, quality feedback, meaningful, timely, whatever, feeding forward, all of those things. And you know, this does it every single time. And people can see that. They get that message. So that's the opportunity. And it's one I'm running with at Hallam, why I do so much work around audio feedback. Just because people love it. And the important thing, I mentioned viral... to you, and it's come up in terms of how do we afford things. It's, I think if we're looking at mainstreaming any learning technology, but this in particular, we have to get people to come and touch the technology. And often that can be through surrogate people like ourselves. In other words, part of staff development, educational development, should be equipping people to pass the message on. I don't know how you do that, but in theory, get them to do the work for you.
In terms of the...
Sorry, you don't have to pass the message on. The most powerful presentation I ever went to when I first got into audio feedback was when a member of staff came along with the students, and this member of staff said, yeah, audio feedback's brilliant, it's a no-brainer, And then the students started saying, and this was good because, and they stayed, and they explained, and you could actually just ask them, how did it make you feel? And then ever since then, I just thought, wow, I've got to try that.
So
any educational intervention I've ever done in my 12 years.
Would you extrapolate from that by saying invite students to multiple staff development workshops?
Absolutely.
You say that would be a useful way to try and get students to come in, and so
because
you can get that impact as well as the solutions.
It's all very well listening to your colleagues in their context, but if you can actually talk to a student who's experienced it, and you can say, oh, well, how did that make you feel? It's much, much more powerful.
Okay, so as with audio, getting some real authentic voices, getting the people in, getting one person to spread the good word to the people they know.
It's interesting because the written feedback is powerful, but actually having the person there giving you listening to the feedback, it gives you the strength.
There's no problem with it. You know, communicating why that's a good idea is really the easiest thing I've ever been involved with. We're about to run out of time.
I think I just want to say some control of expectations is critical, because I'm project managing at the moment a large scale deployment in the podcasting area, and one of the things we've got to make sure is that we have the structures that support all these areas in place.
Yeah.
Because if we get people just running off and pushing into the areas without the backup support, if you get your one man band, they fall flat, and
that's really
the ripple just goes from the institution of this failed.
Yeah, exactly.
We had a big problem at Sheffield with storage and delivery, and I had to actually postpone a ready to roll staff development for 9 months while I waited for that solution. Because I just said to my boss, there is no way I'm going to go and teach people how to podcast when they turn around where we put the podcast. Nowhere, because that would just make a mockery of the whole operation.
Yeah, that's
due to finish
now.
Did you finish now?
10 to.
It's 10 to. Look, I think that's a really good place to stop, actually, because we've got to. But no, actually, it's a really good point. It connects to the audio feedback. Graham, just hold on a sec. Let's just wrap this up. Keep it simple. Don't raise the expectations, because then you are ready to fall. The audio feedback, and I'll talk about audio feedback, but one of the reasons why it works is it's so focused, it's so simple, it's about doing this or doing that, and that's all you're asking, that's all you're expecting. Once they feel success, then they will decide for themselves to explore further. So I think that would be my message from this, but the last couple of points brought together. Can I invite you to contact me? My email box is going to be stuffed, but please do try to stuff my email box. I want to get our survey to higher education institutions out wherever I can. It's asking about this. It's a very simple survey, but I think actually this has been a brilliant discussion to start, and I really think it's something that in podcasting circles we need to continue.
Can I just give a tiny bit of space? We've got funded by the JISC to look at institutional podcasting. The project's called Steeple, as in the church steeple. If you Google Steeple and Oxford, you'll find the website. It's a collaboration between Oxford, Cambridge, and Open University. We've got very good partnerships as well with UCL, Reading, we've been chatting a lot to, and a few other people and stuff like that. We're focusing mainly on kind of quite dull back-end stuff, but we've all been involved in front-end sexy stuff as well. We teach and do other things. What we're trying to do is look at some very tricky-to-solve back-end problems that make the whole thing a lot more efficient. But we're very interested in nearly all aspects of podcasting, because we do it as part of our jobs. So it's a conference in April and everybody's welcome. Unfortunately, it's a bit of money to pay for it. But if you just want to get involved, have a look on the website for Steeple, Oxford.
And that conference is Beyond Walls on the 4th of April?
Yeah, we've got some flyers. It's been really exciting for me to hear everything Andrew's been saying, because I think it's just fantastic that the community as a whole is trying to move forward in this area. Because it is too tricky for one.
On this one, it will take the community, actually.
Exactly.
And maybe through the ASR project as well. I don't know, you're going to be putting out outputs on this, presumably, as well.
Also, just another one, just remember, it's wider than the UK. You form alliances with a thing called Opencast, which is a group of international things. And they themselves, big institutions internationally, well funded, still think it's beyond them to kind of move forward. So.
We need to do more on this subject, I think, as a SIG. I think it's a really useful role for us to have. Let's leave it there, and have we got some coffee?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great.